Blog Talk Radio.
Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me today are my dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston, Pamela Chaddock, and Marvin Garin. Hi, you guys.
Hi,
hey, Paula.
Good
morning.
Hey, Marvin.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Chuck, Pam.
Hey, Marvin.
Pam,
hey,
Paula.
Everyone.
Yes. Welcome. Well, I'm so glad to be here with you today. This always makes my week. And I want to do a shout-out to Annie Zonneveld, the singer of our beautiful theme song, which is a poem from the beloved Rabia, Sufi poet. And Annie did such a beautiful job. She's a Muslim imam, singer, songwriter, activist, and writer. And very much appreciate her letting us use her beautiful music to begin our show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a sweet song. I got to tell you, I was thrilled when I was at our Urantia conference. I think it was last summer, and our dear friend led us in that very song. I thought, this is great. We've come full circle. That was the beautiful Sally Annabella who did that. So that was really special.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Led us in our theme song from Rabia's poem. In my soul. Go ahead, Marv.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, what a delight to be back with you all again. And, you know, we met last week, had a really rich session. And the thought that popped into my head, you know, they talk about different senses of time. There's a mindal sense of time. There's a sense of time passing physically or materially. But they also say there's a unique perception of time that relates to personality, that is only experienced by persons. And I, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this, but for me, there's this phenomenon of with people that I know and love, I could not see them for a year or 2 years. And when I see them again, it's like no time has passed. We pick up right where we left off in terms of sharing. And it's kind of like that here in the Cosmic Citizen Show. You know, it's almost like, it's almost like we let off 5 minutes ago and we're back again. You know, there's something about it that really feels different in terms of the passage of time.
Yeah, there's a thread. Yes.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. I see that. Exactly. I feel that. You know, I like to tell people the heart, the love that you have in your heart is like paradise. It's timeless and spaceless. Mm. And and that is true because no matter how much time and space comes between you and the ones you love, when you see them again, it's as if no time and space ever came between you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like that all the way up, Marvin, all the way to paradise, you know. Maybe 10,000 years go by before we see a loved one that we knew and loved so well somewhere along the way, you know. Mm-hmm. But when we see him again, it'll be like no time and space ever came between us, you know.
That, that what you just quoted there, Marvin, that's from that list of personalities, maybe characteristics or observations, maybe is a better word, that, you know, at the beginning of the personality survival paper. And I've also just been fascinated by that. It's number four. It's the last one on the list. And it, the whole thing reads, personality is uniquely conscious of time. And this is something other than the time perception of mind or spirit. And I think that that maybe is somehow related to number 11. Which is I've also found endlessly fascinating. Number 11 says, personality responds directly to other personality presence. And I've always thought of that one as, particularly in relation to God. You know, God's presence is everywhere, right? It's omnipresent. So that means that we can have a personality relationship with God anywhere. Personality responds directly to other personality presence.
Wow. Yeah.
So if we think of God being the other personality who's present everywhere, that means we can have that direct response, the personality response. So again, this is something that sounds unique to personality, just like the thing with time.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. Yeah, sorry, go ahead. I'll say my song.
Yeah, no, that was it. I just kind of try to get a feel of maybe those two are related in some way. You know,
well,
given what you're saying about feeling like you just pick up with somebody the next time you see them, that there's that direct response, personality to personality.
Yeah. Wow,
yeah.
True.
Well, and I mean, this is interesting because we're in paper six, which is on the Eternal Son, and the Eternal Son is the epitomization. He's the embodiment of a person, right? He was the first created person. Personality,
right?
And so they say that the Eternal Son is uniquely expressive of being a person, and so that's really interesting. And I mean, it makes me think that the nature of personality is such that it's in a sense it precedes the existence of time and space. You know, personality existed before God manifested anything else. And so what it says to me is that there's something about the way we are as persons and the way we relate to each other in personal relationships that is really, I won't say it's outside of, but it's almost irrespective of time and space. It's a different level of phenomenon.
And that feels
right. It feels like what we have with each other when it's really special and spiritually grounded, it is really a phenomenon that it's a very high order phenomenon. It just feels like.
Without a doubt it is. And you know, they established that early on in the foreword, actually. This is from I'll read this. It's from the foreword. It's section 5, paragraph 11. Is that what you just quoted, Chuck?
No, personality. Survival paper.
Okay.
Yeah, it was 112.
Okay.
It was 112.
Yeah, it was 112. Okay, so in the foreword on section 5, paragraph 11, it says personality. The personality of mortal man is neither body, mind, nor spirit. Neither is it the soul. Personality is the one changeless reality in an otherwise ever-changing creature experience. And it unifies all other associated factors of individuality. The personality is the unique bestowal which the Universal Father makes upon the living and associated energies of matter, mind, and spirit. and which survives with the survival of the Maracha soul. That's a great definition.
Yes, it is.
Of personality.
So, you know, also, let me just toss one other small thing in here. This goes back to paper 112 again. One of the most intriguing statements about personality for me, especially, you know, we're all kind of a little bit different. I tend to think naturally, sort of systemically, you know, the way things are in wholes and the way parts are arranged in wholes. And there's this short paragraph, which has got so much content in it. It's 112:119. And it's very related to what you were reading, Paul, about the different parts and the absolutely unique arrangement of those parts and interaction of those parts in each unique personality. There's no mistaking Paula from Marvin, from Chuck, from Pam. I mean, no one would mistake us, right? And yet there are endless trillions of variations on this same theme of a body, you know, some kind of manifestation form, whether it's physical, moral, or spiritual, a body, a mind, a spirit fragment, and a soul, the emerging soul, all of which are arranged systemically in this higher order phenomenon that is a person. And so here's this paragraph. It says, in aggregations, parts are added. In systems, parts are arranged.
Mm-hmm.
Systems are significant because of organization positional values. This is such great language. In a good system,
it's the last paragraph. Sorry.
112:119.
Yeah. In a good system, all factors are in cosmic position. In a bad system, something is either missing or displaced. Mm-hmm. Deranged, which is very interesting because that's a psychological term. And then the last sentence, in the human system, it is the personality which unifies all activities and in turn imparts the qualities of identity and creativity.
Wow.
So it's just...
Yeah.
It's an amazing description of personality as a systemic arrangement of the different constituent parts of a human being, of a mortal being. It's just really fascinating.
And the personality isn't any of those things. That's what was kind of so interesting about that definition that you read a minute ago, that you read, Paula, is that it's sort of defined by all the things it's not.
Yeah.
You know? That definition in the forward kind of reads
cosmic position, positional values. And I'll just say one other thing. There's a couple statements in the book about the thought adjuster being the nucleus of human personality, which is, when you put that together with this systemic language, is very thought-provoking. It's basically saying the way the planets orbit the sun, the way electrons or protons orbit the nucleus of an atom, that's our situation in our persons, right? And when we are properly centered around the nucleus of who we are, the spirit fragment, then everything is in cosmic position and things are functioning the way they're designed to function. And so much of the time, that isn't happening in human beings' lives. You know, the spirit is not the functional center. And so it ends up in endless trouble for human beings because the system is misaligned.
So, it's like the nucleus has been moved. or maybe even, Well, I think that's so important. You know what comes to mind, Marvin, is a good team. When I hear that paragraph, I think of a good team. Everybody's playing their position. A good team, what a good coach will do is arrange all the players to their utmost, right, to their best abilities, and you know, keep them working together and unified, you know, so that personality is what unifies. It says in the paragraph just above, that one you read in 18, it says, in the human organism, the summation of its parts constitutes selfhood, individuality. But such a process has nothing whatever to do with personality, which is the unifier of all these factors as related to mm-hmm. cosmic realities. So, you know, mm-hmm. Mo always likes to say it's the glue that holds everything together. But it's almost like the unique form, too, you know, that they all fit into. And mm-hmm. and I also, when I think of parts deranged, you know, I can't help but think of this planet. Something is missing here. Adam and Eve is missing, mm-hmm. you know. A healthy, normal planetary center of mm-hmm. civilization is missing.
Right.
You know, I mean, and it's really interesting then how, you know, this whole world actually is deranged by that definition, you know,
mm-hmm.
because
well,
the parts aren't there.
Yeah, yeah.
Go
and,
ahead.
And here's one more paragraph, which always for me is connected with that systems paragraph, and it's 12.9.6. It's such an incredible paragraph and has such powerful psychological implications. So they say, mortal man has a spirit nucleus.
Mm.
The mind is a personal energy system existing around a divine spirit nucleus and mm. functioning in a material environment. Such a living relationship of personal mind and spirit constitutes the universe potential of eternal personality. Real trouble, lasting disappointment, serious defeat, or inescapable death can come only after self-concepts presume fully to displace the governing power of the central spirit nucleus, thereby mm-hmm. disrupting the cosmic scheme of personality identity. So
wow.
that language is almost a visual. You know, it's like our self-concept
mm-hmm.
shove out of the center the function of the spirit nucleus, and then we're careening in a self-destructive direction, and the results can be disastrous.
Mm. That is a great paragraph.
Oh, it's mm-hmm. incredible.
You really do see it. You know, God has mm-hmm. to be at the center. That's our balance.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and when people say they're feeling off center or something, I really take that to heart because that's a serious problem that can get worse
yeah.
if they don't do something to get their balance back, their center, their groundedness.
And when
what
I think
about
worship, worship is a centering process. It's like, that's why
yes,
I like that term,
right.
centering.
And prayer,
centering.
Too.
The meditation, prayer, worship sort of rearranges us inside so that systemically
mm.
we're in right position. All the parts fall into
mm-hmm.
right position. Yeah.
Yeah. Chuck, do you still have your thought too?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say that this displacement they're talking about says real trouble can only come after self-concepts, the governing power of the central spirit
right.
nucleus. That is it's something that's an act of will. That's a choice. Just, you know, giving undue importance to self-concepts over this inner resource that's trying to establish our identity, you know, our inner spirit is trying to establish our identity. So the personality has the governing influence over whether that happens or not. Because our will, as I understand it, is derived from our personality.
Mm-hmm.
So we can choose to search for God, you know, and become transformed thereby. Or we can choose to just go with,
mm-hmm.
or not informed that way. And
mm-hmm.
that's, so the point I'm trying to make there is the seeing the role of personality in how the system functions. And one of the things that I've been intrigued by when thinking about that, like going back to this definition in the foreword, when I was saying that they sort of define the personality by what it's not. You know, they say the personality of mortal man is neither body, mind, nor spirit. Neither is it the soul.
Mm.
So those are the components of our system, you might say, you know, our body, our mind, even the thought, thought adjuster, you know, is gifted to be part of our system of selfhood. And even our soul, you know, that's a tangible reality that's growing and changing. But the personality, I like to think of the personality as sort of like the end user. You know, you think of like the end user of a computer system, say, for example. You know, you've got the hardware, you've got the software, you've got the purposes that it can serve, you know, word processing, design, who knows. There's all of that, but it's just sitting there. It doesn't
unless
do anything
there's a person.
Until the end user, like, turns it on and decides to do something with that system. And then it can be taken in any one of all kinds of directions, obviously. I mean, not to oversimplify things, but I think we're kind of like that. Our personality is the end user of this system we've been given, this marvelous system. I mean, everything about it, if you think about it, even just our body, you know, it's like just incomprehensibly complex and yet somehow perfect, you know, even with all of its problems. But what's the design that's gone into our body, I might say, is just like marvelous beyond measure, I'd say. And then our minds, they're gifted, you know, they're on loan, you know, but our minds just like, wow, the way they function once we sort of figure out how to use our minds. And then we have the spirit gift of identity potential also within us. And then our growing soul as well. So, but yet there's still a layer of responsibility, I guess is what I'm trying to point to.
Yes.
And the responsibility for how the system is used for good or ill lies with the personality decisions that are enacted through mind. But it's really the chooser in all of this is the personality. That's why I like to think of the personality sort of the end user. that's where the accountability, that's the accountability level also, you know, the responsibility level maybe is another way of putting it. Because the mind on its own doesn't have responsibility. It'll run off and do whatever it wants, you know. We have to rein in our minds and make them serve us. And same with all of these system components, in a sense.
Paper 110. Oh, sorry, good joke.
Yeah, no, it's all.
Yeah, paper 110.3.2 talks about that too. The success of your adjuster in the enterprise of piloting you through the mortal life and bringing about your survival depends not so much on the theories of your beliefs as upon your decisions, determinations, and steadfast faith. All these movements of personality growth become powerful influences aiding in your advancement. Because they help you to cooperate with the adjuster, they assist you in ceasing to resist. So,
there you go.
So it's like the derangement is based on resistance to leading.
It can be.
That's really interesting, Pam. Yeah, it feeds that model of the nucleus. It's almost like a kind of gravity, you know.
Yes.
So it's like. When we cease to resist, in other words, if we don't fight it, we naturally would move into a proper set of relationships to that spirit gravity of the thought adjuster inside of us. It's when our self-concepts battle the inherent gravity of the spirit nucleus, the inherent spiritual influence, and that we really go astray, you know, and the whole system gets messed up. Yeah.
Or when our personality allows that.
It goes on to say, allowing it, choosing it.
You know, there's a passive attitude that maybe can creep in. The reach for spirit, the engagement with God, the choice to become identified with that inner spirit. I mean, that's a very active, dynamic thing. That's something we have to do, right? Not
especially
always easy,
on this,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it says the end of that paragraph also says that the secret of survival is wrapped up in the supreme human desire to be godlike.
Right.
And in the associated willingness to do and be in any all things which are essential to that.
Willingness to do and be. Right. Willingness to do and be. That's crucial language.
Yeah, really.
I've always loved that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Willingness to do and be. Yeah, I love the, you know, back, one of my favorite quotes, obviously, is 12:7-9, and that's the one about the love of the Father, which absolutely individualizes each personality as a unique child of the universal Father, a child without duplicate in infinity, a will creature irreplaceable in all eternity. You know, that unique personality, that's it. Those other things, those are pretty much the same, you know? I mean, our mind is on loan from the Mother Spirit, right? That we, it's not unique. Or our soul really isn't, you know, I mean, our soul is unique, but I mean the spirit fragment within us is not unique. It's identical to every other spirit fragment. So that personality that the Father bestows, each personality, is a unique child.
That's our source of really, uniqueness.
Yeah, that's the source of it. And it's mind-boggling. And Marvin, I'm going to ask you something because, you know, you hear as you go along in this world things like, well, that's a personality disorder. And as the Rancher book defines personality, I don't think that's even possible. Do you? I mean, what do you think after all these years in your occupation? Do people have personality disorders, or is that something else that's going on within the human being?
No, it's a very interesting question, and I think there's some validity to it. What you're talking about, Paul, is there are various sort of overall categories in the diagnostic nomenclature, the diagnostic literature in psychology. And so there are groups of disorders, and one of those groups, I mean, there are mood disorders like depression, bipolar, and there are mind disruption disorders like schizophrenia, and then there are this group of disorders called personality disorders. So the theory, and I think it has some validity, is that when a child grows up in a family environment and it's specifically tied to the first 5 years of life, which is interesting, because that's before the thought just arrives, that when there are really distorting influences, usually trauma, abuse, neglect, abandonment, during those first years, formative years, the theory is that the very shape of the personality is distorted. So the metaphor I like to use is, and probably think a little bit of what Judas struggled with, you know, when you think about this. But the metaphor I like to use is, if you have a tree that's a fully grown tree, and you want to sort of shape it some or change it, you can trim the branches and you can trim individual parts of the tree. But if the shape of the trunk itself is distorted and misaligned, you can't change that. Because if you try and cut it apart and rearrange it, you destroy the tree. So that's sort of a metaphor for what the personality disorders are. So you've got like sociopathic personality disorders or narcissistic or paranoid personality disorders. Those are all variations. And the idea is that it's a lifelong pattern and is very resistant to change. So it's almost like the cast of the personality has been set from an early stage. Now, obviously,
damaged, maybe.
Misshaped is really the best.
Yeah, misshaped.
Analogy. Crippled, misshaped. But you know, obviously, you get to the mansion walls, and the angelic therapists there will be working on levels we can hardly touch. And so, you know, I'm sure there's hope for anyone with that degree of difficulty. But down here in this life, it can have profound effects. It's difficult. You're going to live with it for the duration. And you can mitigate it, but you can't change the underlying dynamic.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Kind of add one thought to that, if I could, that helps me understand these things, which is I would refer to those distortions of personality as distortions of the expression of personality. Personality is changeless. Personality itself, at least in your Rancher book terms, is not exists on another level from all the things that happen to us during our lives and their effects and everything else. So even in the Urantia book, they talk about developing, you know, the personality along the lines of the Jesus personality, for example. What they're really saying there, I think, is you can develop an expression of your personality along the lines of Jesus' personality. We're not actually changing our personality. We're
right.
We're it's functioning more effectively by virtue of our choices and decisions and just practice and all of those kind of things. So to me, that's a kind of a more hopeful way of understanding it, at least in terms of you know, distortions of human psychology and the disorders, that they're really a disorder of the expression of personality. It's kind of
right,
like,
and it could be because
kind of like
all that trauma is getting in the way, right?
That's had an enduring influence, but
personality
itself is
changeless and just what Father wanted us to have.
So, we can always, if we can find our true self, you might say. But I was just starting to say, it's kind of like epigenetics, what they're learning about epigenetics. So the epigenetics controls the expression of the underlying genetics. And the epigenetics can be messed up, you know, in a given generation, if you lack nutrition or who knows what. You can get the physical disorders, but yet the underlying genetics is still protected. So if the epigenetics can be improved, then the full expression of the underlying genetics can then, you know, have an opportunity to be expressed. So I kind of think of personality like that. It's almost like we have personality epigenetics, you know, all the things that have affected our ability to express our personality. And that's something we can always work on.
Yeah, I think.
Well, you have to be able to see it. And sometimes it's too deep to see. And so, you know.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm not saying that we're not completely, you know, sometimes maybe, well, I don't know about, we stay hopelessly, but, you know.
But there is comfort in knowing that there's another life and there's remedial worlds that will help us overcome all of this. And I still hear Jesus telling John Mark, you know, the first few years of life can affect the entire afterlife. And then I think, okay, is he talking about the entire human afterlife or the entire afterlife?
No, I
but,
think so.
Yeah,
I think
it is the human life.
Yeah, because they say even by the end of the Mansion World, all marks of the beast have been eradicated. So, I mean, obviously there are profound changes in the eternal ascent.
Right.
But you know, there's I would add just a couple of things to what you were saying, Chuck. One is it's not just the expression of personality. It's the perception of personality, meaning when you have a personality disorder, and it's true for all of us, we filter and interpret the incoming data of reality in ways that are particular to our personality and our history. And so it's not only expression, it's the whole way we understand and configure reality on the inside that then gives expression to the external manifestations that are unique to each person. And there's one way for me to understand some of these statements that seem really difficult, they seem almost contradictory, that how is it that a person can grow but not change, right? And I think what they're saying is my personality will never change. I will grow. But what they're saying is I will never not be Marvin and become Paula. Right.
Yeah, right.
I will never change. My personality won't change to be another person. That's what they're saying when you say personality does not change. You will always be you. You will go through endless transformations, but you will always be the unique person that God made you to be. You'll never become another person. So that's what I think they mean by personality does not change, but it does grow.
Well,
good.
And I would say that our expression or our personality is what grows, but, you know, maybe that's the semantics, who knows.
Well, you know, I think the actual personality grows. It's just like a little child becomes an adolescent, and then becomes an adult. I mean, so, And a rose plant is a seed, and then a young plant, and then a fully blossoming bush. So the plant grows, moves through different forms of manifestation, but it's always the rose bush. It's always the same rose.
Yeah, so we're like that too.
Yeah.
Well, neat conversation,
but
you guys.
I think there's a higher level of the changeless nature of personality. That it is really changeless.
And to your point, from someone else, but.
Yeah.
You brought this up, Chuck. You were referring to the Eternal Son, the original. You know, or I guess you could say the Father is the original personality, but the Son is, you know, the next person. And,
well,
and
maybe we should read about his attributes.
Well, yeah.
the Father is the original creator personality, and the Eternal Son is the original and first created person.
I want to share Gary's thoughts too on the board, because he says, referring to what I said about Jesus, you know, talking to John Mark, Gary said, I think Jesus means it affects all our lives. Our forever existence is shaped in some subtle way and is formed by our genesis. People who do not live on a mortal world until they are 15 to 16 do not become finaliters, for instance. That's an interesting thought. So, and we could, you know, probably do another 30 minutes on just that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it is interesting that who we are is shaped, you know, so much of who we are now is shaped by those first 5 years, Marvin, as you pointed out. And then we get our adjuster. And that's
like
an amazing thing.
The significance of origins.
It's like that tree that grows on the rocky crag, right? And it grows kind of twisted, and it's reaching for the sun. And as you pointed out, Marvin, it will always be twisted. You know, it doesn't mean it isn't beautiful and perfect and replete in its own way. But it's affected by the environment, and it will always have that initial affectation.
There's an important caveat to that, Paula, and I think we were saying this earlier. I think it will, that's what Jesus said, your entire afterlife. I think it will remain twisted and misshapen in this life. But I do think up on the Imagine Worlds, our celestial helpers have the skills and capability to help us, if we're in that misfortunate position. Because, you know, folks like that are the victims of their early environment. They didn't do anything to become that way. But everyone will have the chance to realign and get reshaped in a healthy fashion in those early Imagine Worlds. I'm quite convinced of that.
And, of course, you do have a brand new body and a new mind, an incredible mind, 70 senses. We can't even imagine, you know, what that's like. So, and they have a lot to work with up there that we don't have to work with down here, you know, in our effort to help people navigate this most difficult world.
I mean, you've got therapists there who've been doing their work for millions of years. There's a level of
there,
you know.
Good point. I sometimes forget that point, and then when I come back to it, I'm like, oh yeah, right. They know exactly what they're doing, you know.
Oh yeah.
Because you look at different problems on the planet, you think, how are we ever going to solve this, you know? And I think, well, if you guys aren't worried, I'm not going to be worried about it either. You know better than I do.
Actually, you know, it turns out that the significance of origins are ascendant Trinitized sons. So I was wrong about them being an angelic order. But it's interesting what they do. I just read just a little bit of this. They say that the ascendant Trinitized sons of the super universe government are charged with these significance of origins, in other words, are charged with the responsibility of dealing with all issues growing out of the origin of any individual, race, or world. And the significance of origin is the paramount question in all our plans for the cosmic advancement of the living creatures of the realm. Mm-hmm. All relationships and the application of ethics grow out of the fundamental facts of origin. Origin, now this is, I think, especially interesting. It says origin is the basis of the relational reaction of the gods. Conjoined actor, quote, take note of the man in what manner he was born.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they're saying mm-hmm. that God's relation to us is shaped by these factors as well as our relation to God.
Yeah,
it makes sense.
There's a customizing mm-hmm. of, you know, the
yes.
divine influence that's
yes.
tailored to
well,
our origin.
Yeah.
And don't they work,
which makes sense.
Don't they
it would
work,
have to be, I guess. But.
Don't they work closely with another order that's something about mercies?
Yeah, the memory of mercy, exactly.
Yeah.
The memory of mercy.
That's
so
our mercy.
Yeah, so that the God's
yeah.
attitude toward us of merciful reclamation, rehabilitation, flows
yeah.
from a profound sense of our origins. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
the,
I love that.
The import of time
no.
is another one.
The
yeah.
designation of Agendotter, and Gary said it too. Gary, great, we're thinking alike. Agendotter is a good example of how, you know, you get a designation that kind of, or a, I don't know, let's say a flavor, an attribute that stays with you for eternity. It's
yeah.
something that distinguishes you.
Mm-hmm. Well, maleness
and
femaleness.
Maleness and femaleness is another one.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
yeah. Agendotter is a good example of that. You know, because
mm-hmm.
of the world that we were born on, because of the world that we have to deal with, because we have to exercise faith without any real visible assurances of it, you know, in the material world, we become Agendotters, and that stays with us forever.
You know, I think
yeah.
there's another formative influence that we've talked about it some, but I think about it every now and then, and that is, being an evolutionary creature in intimate association with a revelation, with an epical revelation, I think changes us. Marks us in some fundamental ways that puts that stamp on us that I think will
yeah,
always
I think you're
be
right.
part of our character all the way up to paradise. I think so.
I agree. I can't see how it would not be that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And
well,
and
like
think about it. At some
mm-hmm.
some point, this whole planet's going to have that pretty much in common.
Yeah.
I mean, studying the Ransom
yeah.
Book is almost like a Manson World course. You know, it's like
I
we're
agree.
Getting our Manson World orientation while we're still physical down here on this planet,
mm-hmm.
in a way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, but
mm-hmm.
but yeah, I mean, it's certainly changed me. I can't imagine.
Yeah.
You want to think about
oh,
it.
And in ways we can't imagine, in ways that we
yeah.
aren't aware of, really. I think,
but yeah, ones we are ways we're not aware of, probably. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like
yeah.
Jesus said to the apostles. You know, he said, you are like ambassadors from a future
mm-hmm.
age, and
yeah.
having
right.
having spent this time with me, you are like ambassadors from a future age. And I kind of feel like we get to have this manual for ambassadors of a future age, this 2,000 page manual that has affected our lives from many of us
yeah.
from early times, you know. So it's
mm-hmm.
yeah. that's
that,
an interesting, unique experience.
Yeah,
that
idea of being in the world and not of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Marvin, I'm really glad you brought that up because I feel really estranged in a way from those fellow humans that don't accept the revelation or they reject it or whatever. It's like the beautiful bubble of futurism that we can see because we take on the revelation is missing in their lives, and I find it so hard to communicate that great experience to somebody that has no ears to hear it or has chosen to resist. you know?
Right.
You know, that's interesting. Yeah, that's
I wish
really
I understood that.
You know, there's a parallel there that it just occurs to me as you were describing that, because I think, because most of them are sincere spiritual seekers, but they just, they can't really grasp or take in that revelation, and so they put it aside. And for me, there's really a parallel to Jesus and Matadormus, you know, when they say, you know, if you could just really embrace the wholeness of the gospel and make that leap, then you could be in, you know, in with this group of evangelists and apostles. And they say Matadormus couldn't do that. He couldn't give up his worldly perspective in order to accept the revelatory perspective.
Yeah.
And as a result, they say he missed out on the opportunity, which he wasn't able to take advantage of until later. But then it was, in a sense, too late. Missed out on the
for
opportunity
for him to be with Jesus.
Working with the revelation, yeah. So I think a lot of these folks will get everything that we have gotten from the revelation, but they're going to get it on the mansion worlds, which means they will have missed the opportunity to function with faith in this life with those perspectives. So that's an interesting parallel.
It's almost like they need to be, it's almost as if it's another form of being born again.
Yeah.
To allow yourself to jump the cavern, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's
well,
it's,
part of that
I'm
think
struggling
is,
with it. I really am.
I think
how to reach people, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't mean you to be an ambassador.
About the Irascible.
No one said it was going to be easy.
one of the things I've noticed about whether people take on the Irascible or not is you have to be asking the questions that it answers. If you're not asking the questions that it answers, it's just a big book with a lot of pages, you know. You're not going to have the motivation or the desire to dig into it. And I think you can count me on that. I mean, isn't that true for all of us? I mean, we were asking the questions.
Hungry.
They were burning in our hearts and minds even. And then you see that this is providing answers to those questions that you've maybe been asking for years.
So we need to whet their appetite. Somehow.
Yeah, something like that. Something like that. They're
something
just not
like
asking
that.
And
those
that's
questions
tricky
for whatever reason.
It's
how
tricky
people
right
could go
that's
through
tricky
life not asking the big questions is baffling to me.
They just assume that there's no
walk
answers
out the door every day. Not wondering.
They've kind of given up.
On, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, Paul,
I'm winning the appetite.
I think we. I'm sort of feeling the ghost of Andre past.
Yeah.
You guys, you're almost a full hour into the program here.
Yeah, he would admonish us for sure. He would have 15 minutes ago.
We almost got there a few minutes ago.
Yeah, we almost did.
Who wants to read section for the attributes of the Eternal Son?
Pam, do you want to read? Are you up for it?
Oh, I don't know. My voice is crackly this morning. It's not.
I can.
Not very pleasant.
Okay, Marvin, go ahead.
Thank you, Marvin.
Yeah, I gotta take a little libation here because quell my own crackliness. Attributes of the Eternal Son. And this is in the paper 6, section 4, on the Eternal Son. So the Eternal Son motivates the spirit level of cosmic reality. The spiritual power of the Son is absolute in relation to all universe actualities. He exercises perfect control over the interassociation of all undifferentiated spirit energy and over all actualized spirit reality through his absolute grasp of spirit gravity. All pure, unfragmented spirit and all spiritual beings and values are responsive to the infinite drawing power of the primal Son of Paradise. And if the eternal future should witness the appearance of an unlimited universe. The spirit gravity and the spirit power of the original sun will be found wholly adequate for the spiritual control and effective administration of such a boundless creation. Wow. Quite a first paragraph.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah. The sun is omnipotent only in the spiritual realm. In the eternal economy of universe administration, wasteful and needless repetition of function is never encountered. The deities are not given to useless duplication of universe ministry.
And why would they be? I just have
yeah.
to throw that in there.
being perfect.
Being perfect.
Yeah. The omnipresence of the original sun, constitutes the spiritual unity of the universe of universes. The spiritual cohesion of all creation rests upon the everywhere active presence of the divine spirit of the eternal Son. When we conceive of the Father's spiritual presence, we find it difficult to differentiate it in our thinking from the spiritual presence of the eternal Son. The spirit of the Father is eternally resident in the spirit of the Son.
Mm-hmm.
The Father must be spiritually omnipresent, but such omnipresence appears to be inseparable from the everywhere spirit activities of the eternal Son. We do, however, believe that in all situations of Father-Son presence of a dual spiritual nature, the spirit of the Son is coordinate with the spirit of the Father. In his contact with personality, the Father acts in the personality circuit. In his personal and detectable contact with spiritual creation, he appears in the fragments of the totality of his deity, and these Father fragments have a solitary, unique, and exclusive function wherever and whenever they appear in the universes. In all such situations, the spirit of the Son is coordinate with the spiritual function of the fragmented presence of the Universal Father. We'll have to come back and talk about it. I think of the thought adjusters and the spirit of truth here, you know, and how they work
yeah.
so closely. Yeah, yeah. Spiritually, the Eternal Son is omnipresent. The spirit of the Eternal Son is most certainly with you and around you, but not within you and a part of you like the mystery monitor. So that with you and around you, but not within us and part of us. The indwelling Father fragment adjusts the human mind to progressively divine attitudes, whereupon such an ascending mind becomes increasingly responsive to the spiritual drawing power of the all-powerful spirit gravity circuit of the second source and center. The original Son is universally and spiritually self-conscious. In wisdom, the Son is the full equal of the Father. In the realms of knowledge, omniscience, we cannot distinguish between the first and second sources. Like the Father, the Son knows all. He is never surprised by any universe event. He comprehends the end from the beginning. The Father and Son really know the number and whereabouts of all the spirits and spiritualized beings in the universe of universes. Not only does the Son know all things by virtue of his own omnipresent spirit, but the Son, equally with the Father and the conjoint actor, is fully cognizant of the vast reflectivity intelligence of the Supreme Being, which intelligence is at all times aware of all things that transpire on all worlds of the seven super universes. And there are other ways in which the Paradise Sun is omniscient. The Eternal Sun, as a loving, merciful, and ministering spiritual personality, is wholly and infinitely equal with the Universal Father. I'm just going to read that again. The Eternal Sun, as a loving, merciful, and ministering spiritual personality, is wholly and infinitely equal with the Universal Father, while in all those merciful and affectionate personal contacts with the ascendant beings of the lower realms, the Eternal Sun is just as kind and considerate, just as patient and long-suffering, as are his Paradise Sons in the local universes, who so frequently bestow themselves upon the evolutionary worlds of time. It is needless further to expatiate on the attributes of the Eternal Sun. With the exceptions noted, it is only necessary to study the spiritual attributes of God the Father to understand and correctly evaluate the attributes of God the Son.
Which explains why
they
put five papers on the Universal Father, right? And
yes, exactly.
And only two on the Son, because they really, you know, it's like Jesus saying, "Who has seen the Father has seen me."
Yep.
So, He who has seen me has seen the Father. And I guess you could go the other way too, but you would see him first. But those attributes are all there and present in the Eternal Son.
You know, what's just occurred to me as we read this is that whenever the Creator Sons bestow themselves in the likeness of their creatures and all the way down to us as a mortal, you know, human being, that those experiences and those lives, I've got to assume, are part of the awareness and omniscience of the Eternal Son. So while the Eternal Son doesn't actually have those experiences himself, he must incorporate them into his being because the Creator Sons and the Eternal Son are joined in a sense.
Mm. Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We're back to that, the idea that once you've experienced something, it's a part of you. It's like Michael, you know, Jesus on this planet. That whole experience is a part of him. He will forever be Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah, they say that.
And he will ever forever be even Todd and, you know, the Melchizedek.
It's all
and
part of
all
the
of
experiential,
it.
Experiential memory. Sure.
Yeah.
There's a interesting, parallel here to something that I've focused on a lot before, but had never noticed it in this particular passage. In paper 6, section 5, paragraph 7, at the end of that paragraph, they say the Father, talking to the Son, protecting the bestowal of the thought adjusters, proposed, "Let us make mortal man in our own image." And then it goes on to say, "And as the spirit fragment of the Father dwells within you, so does the spirit presence of the Son envelop you, while these two forever work as one for your spiritual advancement." And then in what we just read, they say the spirit of the Eternal Son is most certainly with you and around you,
mm-hmm, right.
But not within you and a part of you, like the mystery monitor. So those two passages essentially kind of saying the same thing in an interesting way. But, you know, exactly. But it's getting the same idea across. So this image of being enveloped or having the spirit of the eternal Son, you know, around us, or around each one of us, that I assume would be also consistent with the spirit of truth, which, you know,
that
relationship to the Eternal Son. So we can kind of think of the spirit of truth that way, as enveloping us or being around us. I don't know. Does that make sense?
But here's a caveat, Chuck.
Yeah,
here's
I
a caveat
the
with
fear
that.
Of gravity,
when
sure.
when Jesus says, "I stand at the door of men's
yeah.
souls, men's hearts, and
spirit
knock."
Of truth as a gravity.
And if any will open to me, I will come
pulling
in.
Godward.
And I think
more truth.
If with. I'm sorry, Pam, are you there? Oh, can you guys hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Hello?
I can hear you, but I think both of you are talking at the same time. Somewhere. Yeah.
I'm
so
wondering
maybe,
if she could hear me. She may not have been able to, and she's dropped off now. So darn it. But
yeah,
yeah uh-huh. I just think that the spirit of
for sure.
Well, yeah, and what occurred to me when you were saying that, I thought of that, and I thought, okay, that would explain how we can be in all of that, even have the Father within us, and all of these wonderful things surrounding us, but we still have the sovereign choice whether or not to let it in.
Yeah.
And the Spirit
well,
of Truth brings it in.
Mm-hmm.
That's now, what occurred to me while you were saying.
Yeah, no, that beautiful way Jesus had of putting that. You know, I stand at the door and knock, and if any man will open, I'll come in. But then it goes on to say, you know, and I'll sup with him, and we'll talk
and
about the affairs of the king, talk about the affairs of the kingdom, and that sort of thing. So it's like we're inviting him into our home, in a sense.
Yes.
So then
yeah.
He's with us.
Right.
Whereas the Father is literally within us.
Right.
So that feeling of having him with us, I think, is more where this enveloping sense maybe could apply.
And we have
well,
to invite
and I think,
him.
And his influence certainly
yeah, we
has
have
an
to
effect
open the
on
door.
Our inner life. I'm not saying that's not the case. But,
so,
but I like
someone
that
wants,
a kind of
wants,
a complemental balance there between an inner experience
right.
and a withness
right.
experience.
And witness, right.
Companionship, yeah. Are your companionship experience.
Anyway.
Right. Well and it's also interesting to add a third element, you know, and so it's like for me this is very visceral. It's almost like I can feel or sense in my environment these different influences in different positions in relationship to me. So I can feel the Father's presence at my core in the deepest place inside of me.
Yeah.
And I can feel Jesus' presence like all around me and by my right shoulder and my left shoulder and just with me and all around me in a sense. And in a
mm-hmm.
sense, when we are together, Jesus is with us and in and around us in the environment. And the angels, the work of the third, you know, the ministers of the third source and center, they say they work in our minds and in our social environment. So it's like what they're doing is particularly being focused on the relationship factors and the interactions between persons. So that fits for me as well. And it's not
mm-hmm.
at all, they don't step on the toes of the Spirit of Truth or the Thought Adjuster. They're perfectly overlapping realms within, around, and between us.
Yeah. Right.
So it's
and
beautifully synchronized ministries, I think.
Yeah.
And
I
we
totally
are an
agree.
Active
and
participant.
The right. presence of the Mother Spirit, we don't want to forget her, you know, her own spirit,
mm-hmm.
her Holy Spirit,
mm-hmm.
they say is a pervading presence. So
mm-hmm.
it's
yeah.
like, it pervades
conspiracy.
Everything.
It's a conspiracy.
It's a conspiracy of endowment. Of endowment.
It's a divine
but
conspiracy.
But I agree that... So I just want to underscore what Marvin was saying there about how these conceptions of deity presence and influence and endowments can become visceral. I like that because that helps
yeah.
me. I mean, I've been working kind of with that idea myself for a while now. That's why I like talking about, okay, within, with me, pervading me. Those I can start to feel in a...
Exactly.
In a, you know, visceral is one way of putting it, but in a... like there's a reality to those things.
A very real
can,
way, yeah.
It gives a, kind of gives me a handle on how to, where to look for the, or how to feel those influences.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
having
so
someone
can,
having
yeah.
someone by my side, having Jesus by my side, like you were sort of suggesting, that's very compelling as an image.
The
yeah.
inner guide, the
yeah.
guide that's always there showing the way.
And
so
then
is,
the Father's presence
is,
within.
Leading
within.
The way.
Yeah. Looking
is,
out,
yeah.
Right.
Is Pam back with us now? Are you back, Pam?
Yeah, yeah. Pam, you were trying to make a point. I'm sorry before you dropped off.
Yeah, go ahead, Pam. Go ahead.
Way back there.
Way back
I'm
there.
Sorry.
Do you remember what it was?
I don't remember.
You just posted.
You were talking about
you just posted
gravity.
You just posted a wonderful quote.
Yeah, and that's where I got the whole idea of conspiracy is from the Mother mm-hmm. Spirit. But yeah, I guess I'm not sure. I think I was leading to the idea that the Spirit of Truth, an example of the Spirit gravity of the Eternal Son.
Oh, yeah.
Pulling us truth towards mm-hmm. truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, our ever guiding light
mm-hmm.
Along the gravity, spirit gravity track.
You know, and mm-hmm. that concept of spirit gravity to me is so unique to the Arranger book mm-hmm. and so
yes.
fundamental to it. And they're really clear here about that. The sun is mm-hmm. that. It's that
yes.
spirit gravity. And yes. there was one paragraph that you read, Marvin, where they say that in pretty complete ways, that he is entirely responsible. It all comes through him. And to me, and Jesus being from that and in that vein,
yeah.
when he says, if you will lift me up, I will draw all men. Mm. To myself.
Mm-hmm.
That is spirit gravity.
Yes.
That, you know,
exactly.
That's what
exactly.
he's talking about. And he'll draw
mm-hmm.
us to him, and then he'll send us on, and the Eternal Son will draw us from there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it draws us anyway, but it's focalized, I think, in the Creator Son. That spirit
yeah.
gravity is focalized in a local universe. At the center, through the sovereign of the universe, the Creator Son,
and I think part of how that functions is in manifestation of coherence. You know, when
yeah.
something makes sense, we're drawn to it. You know, there's almost mm. a gravity involved in that, and
yeah.
there's a
yeah.
really interesting little paragraph here and. In paper two, section 7, paragraph 7, where they say that the eternal quest is for unification, for divine coherence. I just find that so fascinating that they would put it that way. The eternal quest is for divine coherence. And then they say the far-flung physical universe, coheres in the Isle of Paradise. The intellectual universe coheres in the God of mind, the conjoint actor. The spiritual universe is coherent in the personality of the Eternal Son.
mm-hmm.
But the isolated mortal of time and space coheres in God the Father through the direct relationship between the indwelling thought adjuster and the Universal Father. Man's adjuster is a fragment of God and everlastingly seeks for divine unification. It coheres
mm.
with and in the paradise deity of the first source and center. So we have coherence on all these levels, and then it, for us at least, it really, really comes together with, you know, this existent presence within us. That's
so
seeking,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
seeking
so,
unification.
So the takeaway for me is you're right, Chuck. I mean, cohering and coherence, and then there's the word cohesion. All of those are the same
mm-hmm.
root. And what uh-huh. they're saying is that paradise is the source of material or physical cohesion. The spirit is the source of mindal coherence or cohesion. The sun is the essence of spiritual coherence or cohesion, and the Father is the source and the destiny of personality cohesion and coherence.
Wow.
And then there's this paragraph in the section we just read, which really speaks to that about the Son. It's 6:43. He says, the omnipresence of the original sun constitutes the spiritual unity of the universe of universes, the spiritual cohesion of all creation rests upon the everywhere active presence of the divine spirit of the eternal sun. So that's as a word root, coherent, cohesion, cohering, unity, all of those are different ways of saying, you know, a similar kind of phenomenon. So it's really, boy, what a full theology. It's really remarkable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the definition of cohesion, the action or fact of forming a united whole.
Ah.
So that drawing power that pulls you in, you know, and cohesive, it's cohesive to you. You are drawn to it so you can join with it in a united
mm-hmm.
whole.
You know, I keep coming back to this idea. there are two related concepts in physics. One is fractal reality and the other is holographic reality, which have made their way into the culture these days. But a holographic reality is a reality where seemingly there are different parts, but they are really simply facets of a single underlying reality or a gestalt.
Reflectivity.
So like what now?
Reflectivity, Ben.
Yes, exactly. So what they're saying is God and the manifestation of God on all levels is really a singular phenomenon. There's really one thing happening here, but it's in endless variations of expression and realization, downstepped, which is, I don't know, that just really is powerful. That's a powerful conception. Yeah.
There's another term in here that I want to make sure I'm understanding correctly. They say thanks for looking that up, by the way, Paula. That was helpful about cohesion or coherence. They say the omnipresence of the original sun constitutes the spiritual unity of the universe of universes. The word constitutes is I'm looking up some definitions, and I guess they sort of explain it. But anyway, I just wonder if anybody has any thoughts on what they're saying.
The way I understand that
is
it makes
it possible,
it makes it possible. It makes it up. You know, it creates that. It constitutes. It's the makeup. It's the constitution.
Oh, yeah. Constitution. Well, that's an interesting,
Yeah, those are interesting terms. The word constitution. And the way we use it in our culture, like the constitution of our country, and also the word constituents. So we are constituents within a larger constitution of the cosmos. We're just sort of cosmic citizen, you know, in a sense.
Yeah,
So what do we constitute? We constitute the mortal population of the universe.
Right. Reconstituted.
but we are, you know, that concept of one body. I think you were just touching on that. We're all in it. We're all an integral part of it. We can't, you know, it's interesting that we ever think we're separate. But that in itself is an act of will. To believe that you are separate from that reality is an act of will. And it's the ultimate act of will, really.
Well, it's a choice, right.
Yeah, it's a choice to try and believe and then try to function separately from all of the agencies that surround you. and in
while
every
still
way.
Using them.
Yeah, while still using them and yet denying their reality. And so, you know, as you were talking about that, I was thinking, okay, so the human will is the one factor that can cause us to be at odds with that reality. And why that would ever happen, you know, is a mystery, except that early on in a child's life, early on in a world's life, someone teaches us that we are a part of this mm-hmm. greater whole. And we come to understand it more and more as we get older and more mature, that we are a part of this, that to stand against it is like standing against the tide. It's like,
yes.
you know, it's putting ourselves, instead of going with that grand flow of the universe, we're standing against it and letting mm-hmm. it wear us out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good luck
by
with
our
that.
Refusal.
Yeah,
well,
they talk about
being mistaught. Mistaught.
Yeah.
You know, what you're saying about
right.
how we're taught is huge. I mean, in this one comment, they say, the normal urges of animal beings and the natural appetites and impulses of the physical nature are not in conflict with even the highest spiritual attainment, except in the minds of ignorant, mistaught, or unfortunately over-conscientious persons.
That's always intrigued me, Chuck. What do they mean?
Yeah, me too.
And I'm just, because you brought it up, and we have Marvin on the line here. What do
well,
they mean?
Well, it goes along with the idea of
unfortunately,
being yeah.
Well,
over conscientious.
Okay. Yeah, I can talk about that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the it's a little glib, but I mean, it's a label that's well understood in the culture. And that is caretaking and codependence, right?
Mm.
Which is a type of distortion of human personality. In other words, the person who is a codependent caretaker works with the assumption that I am worthless, right? What gives me worth is only what I can do for other people. That is the source of my worth and my value. And so I will sacrifice myself to the point of taking care of other people, to the point of self-destructivity. And that's an overly developed sense of altruism. They talk about that. They say a fascinating thing. They say the thought adjuster works to place a slight, it's in the discussion between the altruistic and the ego, the self-drive and the altruistic drive. And they say the thought adjuster works to place a slight emphasis on the altruistic over the ego, the self needs. And that is consistent with psychological health. In other words, we need to have a healthy balance of taking care of ourselves and our own worth and our own self-value in relationship to taking care of and serving other people. And if we get out of balance in either direction, either we are selfish and non-altruistic, or we're overly altruistic and self-sacrificial, that's not healthy for human development, is what they're saying. And Jesus said a variation on the same thing. He said, I will stop at nothing to restore the self-respect of those who have lost it and to restrain it in those who have overly much self-respect. So, so this is, yeah, that's what they mean by unfortunately overdeveloped altruistic drive. That's my understanding of it. And it fits very well with what we see psychologically as people struggle with these things. And it's interesting that codependence in the 12-step movement and in the addictions literature, codependence is seen as a form of addiction. It's a psychological addiction. In other words, you're addicted to being so self-take care because that's where your utter sense of value comes from. You don't have a sense of value other than your ability to take care of other people, which is really, that's very destructive, very self-destructive.
So well, you can see how it would.
Yeah,
I mean, it's pretty basic to meet your own needs, too, you know, because if you don't, where are you going to get what you need to help anyone else? You know,
yeah.
I think on one of the shows just maybe a couple weeks ago, we came to the conclusion that if you don't love yourself, you know, it's love your neighbors, you love yourself. But if you don't love yourself, how are you going to ever love your neighbor, right?
Well, that's you know, self-sacrificial motivation, if it's taken to its extreme, is suicidal. You destroy yourself.
Yeah, I can see
that. And that's what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, what God doesn't want us to be fundamentally self-sacrificing. He wants us to be self-fulfilled in a balance of being loved by God and by other people and loving other people as well and serving them. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good, Marvin. Thank you.
45 years of as a mental health professional.
Yeah, well,
reading the Arantra book, thinking about these things, yeah.
What was the reference you gave us, Chuck? You read it, but you didn't cite the reference.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that was paper 34, the Mother Spirit paper.
Okay.
Section 7, paragraph.
Okay.
I was just going to comment that there seems to be a difference between altruism and self-sacrifice, perhaps.
Huh.
I mean, self-sacrifice, I mean, it depends on how you define it, I guess. But, you know, altruism can be self-fulfilling.
Well, you know,
parenthood is very self-sacrificing. I mean, in a sense. In other words, you have to put your own needs aside for the welfare of your children, right? And that's part of what that experience is about, learning how to do that. And understanding that our Creator Father is the same way. Yeah. But I don't know if it's not self-sacrifice in the extreme sense that we're talking about here, where it becomes a disorder, I guess you might say. It's more of a realization of responsibility, I guess. And that's
selflessness.
Well, it makes perfect sense. I'm so glad you brought up that thing. You know, in that paper, wow, that paper is really amazing. Paper 34. That's all about
sure
the universe
is.
Mother. But they take that opportunity to say so many things in there to us. You
so
know,
many nuggets in that paper.
Yeah, right. There's so many nuggets in that one. So yeah, thanks for bringing that one up. I've always wondered about that. Over conscientious persons. And Marvin, thank you for the connection between that and codependence. It makes total sense. And
well,
you know, OCD,
I
think Pam
being mistaught. You know, like maybe somebody when you were young was saying, "Oh, you know, you got to do this, you can't do that." I mean, there's an influence of being mistaught implied there.
Mistaught.
Too.
Or ignorant too.
Ignorant too, yeah.
Yeah. Pam put up a definition. It says, a highly conscientious person can also become overly rigid or inflexible and struggle to be spontaneous. In extreme cases, they may struggle with perfectionism and obsessive compulsive disorder. Totally makes sense. Yeah.
So what was the story with Jesus and the dishes? Was it Martha? Who was it that was getting all uptight?
Yeah, it was Martha.
She had to do the dishes or something.
It was Martha.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's a good example.
And she wanted him to chastise Mary because Mary wouldn't get up and do the dishes with her. And he instead admonished her. Why are you so troubled by so many trifles? In Christianity, there are they actually call women who are always serving the Marthas.
Mm-hmm.
They have a name for them. They're the Marthas in Christianity.
So,
they're the ones that are always serving.
Is that
serving.
Positive or negative?
I guess you could take it either way.
So here's the sort of defining paragraph that for me has always spoken to this issue of overly developed altruistic urge. It's 103, section 2, paragraph 10. Man tends to identify the urge to be self-serving with his ego-himself. In contrast, he is inclined to identify the will to be altruistic with some influence outside himself, God. And indeed, is such a judgment right? For all such non-self desires do actually have their origin in the leadings of the indwelling thought adjuster. And this adjuster is a fragment of God. The impulse of the spirit monitor is realized in human consciousness as the urge to be altruistic, fellow creature minded. At least this is the early and fundamental experience of the child's mind. When the growing child fails of personality unification, the altruistic drive may become so overdeveloped as to work serious injury to the welfare of the self. Mm-hmm. A misguided conscience can become responsible for much conflict, worry, sorrow, and no end of unhappiness. But there's one
human
other place where they, there's one other place which I haven't found where they actually say the thought adjuster places a slight emphasis.
Yeah.
And they use the word slight
on
the altruistic drive versus the ego drive. So this paragraph I just read and that paragraph to me is definitive. What they're saying is healthy human development depends upon a slightly more altruistic drive than taking care of the needs of the self. And that allows the adjuster to do its work on a stable basis.
Mm-hmm. Here's another from that same section, sort of parallel idea. It has to do with teaching, where they say, this is in paragraph 6 of that same section, 103.2. They say, in the absence of wrong teaching, the mind of the normal child moves positively in the emergence of religious consciousness toward moral righteousness and social ministry rather than negatively away from sin and guilt. There may or may not be conflict in the development of religious experience, but there are always present the inevitable decisions, effort, and function of the human will. So in the absence of wrong teaching, that functioning of the human will go in a positive direction naturally.
Yeah.
So that really speaks to the importance of teaching.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, yeah, this is all about parental environment and the values that are inculcated. Okay. But here's the other paragraph I found it. It's 103.27. So there, it's all in section paper 103.
Yeah, it's the next paragraph.
Yeah, very next paragraph. Moral choosing is usually accompanied by more or less moral conflict. And this very conflict in the child mind is between the urges of egoism and the impulses of altruism. The thought adjuster does not disregard the personality values of the egoistic motive, but does operate to place a slight preference upon the altruistic impulse as leading to the goal of human happiness, to the joys of the kingdom of heaven. So that's a pretty definitive statement there.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, too, the difference between egoistic and egotistic. I think those two terms maybe kind of get mixed up sometimes. So the Ranch Book speaks pretty strongly about the importance of egoistic development, because that's our ship. You know, that's what carries us through life. You know, we have to have that strong sense of self. But that doesn't mean you become egotistical. You know, that's something different. But there's kind of a phobia around ego, you know, in the culture. People are always trying to blame everything on the ego. Blame everything on the ego, you know, it's like this bad thing. And
well, you could blame survival on it. You know, you have to survive. That's pretty fundamental. Survival is. And I just wanted to add to this conversation that I had a friend who was in a very abusive relationship, which, well, at least as she perceived it, it was abusive. And she didn't understand it very well. Deeply spiritual person. And she was praying about it, trying to understand, you know, what she should do. Should she stay in this relationship? Should she not? And she got a word, and the word was capacity to withstand abuse is not a spiritual value. And I was so glad she shared that with me, because, you know, I think women may be more prone to this than men are. I think men are more naturally have a sense of themselves. You know what I mean? They're not so overly altruistic, you know, and that's pretty well identified. Women are pleasers. Women want to please everybody. Right?
Well, women
make everybody
biologically
happy? That's like my job.
Biologically, women are caretakers from the get-go. I mean, it's a biological role. Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost a natural function. I mean, you almost can't. That's why I find it kind of funny that we'd be held out of ministry because we are ministry. You know, call the mother spirit the divine administer, you know, and the divine minister. And so, you know, it's definitely something that as a woman I've noticed that this is really more difficult. How to balance the needs of yourself with the needs of others, and especially those of your family and friends and the people you love, right? And you know, it can be really tough. It can be really challenging, and I think many, many women neglect themselves and neglect their own needs.
Mm.
And that is hard.
They're often maybe underappreciated too.
Oh, most definitely, because it's almost, well, of course you're going to do it. Of course you will. You know,
I don't know.
Are you going to do? That's your default position. Of course you're going to be there to serve. That's what you do, you know. But then it can lead to feeling guilty if you don't, or if you don't feel compelled to, or whatever. Just like she was grappling with this. She was really grappling with it. And that was such a beautiful word that she got. You know, the thought that came to her is capacity to withstand abuse is not a spiritual value. And that's really helped me.
Powerful.
You know?
Powerful.
Yeah, very powerful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, there's the other thing to think about here, which is really interesting to me, is if you take a look at the state of the world, I would say that the two extremes of this continuum that we're talking about, meaning extreme self-valuing or the pride of Lucifer, right, the pride of ego, pride of rebellion and self-assertion, at one extreme, and the other extreme of profound self-criticism and self-reproach of low self-esteem.
Overconscientiousness.
You know,
yeah.
In its extreme. Those two problem areas, to me, constitute probably the most powerful sets of aberration and difficulty in our world today, where you have people who are overly developed in their self-respect and are narcissistic at one end of the spectrum, and at the other end of the spectrum, people who so loathe themselves that they're suicidal and give up and die, you know, and both those problems are rampant in our world.
I before we went on the air, I was sharing with you guys a young man who came up to the booth, and I could just tell by looking at him that he was just a beautiful, gentle, very gentle soul, you know, just a sweet, gentle soul, and he had a lovely energy, and he was ask me, you know, so what's this about? I said, well, I said, let me ask you. I said, if you could ask God any question, what would you ask him? And he thought for a few seconds, and he said, I'd ask him why I struggle so much with my own self-worth. And I had a wonderful time telling him, you know, that whoever he is beautiful and just exactly who he should be, and that it's okay to be who you are and to have a healthy self-respect for who you are, and that God treasures you. And I told him, God can't replace you. You are unique in eternity without duplicate in infinity. You are, you know, priceless beyond compare. God can never create another you. And he smiled and said, now I know why I needed to come here today.
So beautiful.
You know,
but that is kind of an epidemic. And I probably talked about this before, but I attended a counseling workshop at Burning Man once, and we all got to practice on each other. So, you know, I was trying to counsel all these, like, 20-somethings, right? And they all had the same problem, which they were, like, self-arresting. Like, they were arresting themselves before they fully actualized or fully expressed who they felt they really were. You know, the negative self-talk is part of that, all that sort of complex of things where you stop yourself. Right.
Well, you
and
know,
they were all
I
complaining
think,
about that. They were all complaining about that.
I think it's not at all a coincidence that the singular core truth of the gospel is a loving, nurturing parent-child relationship with God. I don't think that's. I think when Jesus said that which the world needs most to know is that men and women are the sons and daughters of God, and by faith they can daily experience and actually realize and daily experience this ennobling truth, because that truth is transformative. I mean, that's why it's the core truth of the gospel, is because people are dying on the vine for lack of that deep parental nurture that they
can haven't been taught.
And that,
they haven't
in,
been taught
in
that.
They haven't been taught that it's available, you know.
Yeah.
And it's inside, it's intimate, you know, and so that's the core truth of the gospel. That's the good news, is
right.
you're not only valuable, you're treasured. You're the most valuable you that God could make, irreplaceable in all eternity, you know. So it's like, you know, and what Jesus said is that idea is not sufficient. You need to have the experience of feeling that love for you in that inner relationship. And that's the heart of the gospel. That will change the world.
That's so true.
As you're saying that, it just occurs to me that part of that being treasured is our potential is treasured also. Not just who we are in the moment, but our potential. So if you realize that you have potential that's beyond what you are currently, then you get motivated to make that happen. So that's, I think, part of that dynamic of being a child of God is realizing, you know, wow, this is my lineage, this is my ancestry, I'm related to God. Oh my! So that kind of defines our potential going forward into eternity. So that's very motivating. It's like it's a release of if I said I stop myself from just get out there and do what I can and grow as I do it, you know.
Well, that's the companion truth.
Needed.
That's the companion truth of eternal life, you know, that not only am I a beloved child, but I'm a little kid right now. And I get to grow up. I get to grow up and become like mom and dad. You know, I can be what I see them and I love them, and I can become like them, you know. I can mature spiritually, and that's what the whole eternal adventure is all about.
Yeah,
it's not about sitting statically on clouds and playing harps. It's about an incredible adventure of maturation and growth, you know. That's
what it's and potential
being,
fruition of potential. Gary said on the board, I want to share what Gary said to this conversation. He said, the problems of identity, the aberrations of who we are, seem to be caused and sustained by the lack of identification as children of God. It's exactly what you said, Marvin, too.
Yep.
To know we have true identity because we are a part of God's universe. We're in God's family, right? I feel all of these aberrations can be applied to this singular secular decoupling, and I agree, Gary. And I think and one of the problems is, you know, that so much of our scientific, the bent of our scientific minds now is to poo-poo God and like it's a big joke, like it's the big, you know, fairy tale of humanity that there even is a God, you know, and you can see why then there's a crisis of mental health. And that's what I keep hearing.
There are two variations. Go ahead, Pam. Go ahead, and I'll show.
I was going to say that this whole issue with secular and separation from God as materialism. I mean, it's the essence of materialism. It's the split. It keeps us apart. And that's the devil. That is the devil, as the separator is the power that materialism has. And I'm so grateful how the Urantia book describes materialism, especially in secular totalitarianism, all of that, because it really is the issue. It is what is keeping us largely in lockdown. So,
I think there's a secondary issue. I think that's the primary issue, is the idea that there's no one there. There's no God. There's no loving parental presence. But the other problem, I think, is that even for those who believe that there is a God, the conception of it is that it's this far away abstract force, you know, that runs the universe and doesn't really have too much to do with me, little old me.
Right.
And so really, really what the revelators are saying is, no, this is a problem when you think God doesn't have much to do with you. He's too busy running the universe, because God wants everything to do with you.
Yeah.
He wants to be involved with you at every moment of your life and share life with you. And that nurture of being a beloved child is available in every moment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, that's the other problem, is people think, yeah, I believe in it, but it's so far away, it's not really particularly helpful or relevant to me.
That's,
you know? And that's a big problem. That's a big problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a kind of an interesting section there. I don't know if it's too much to read, but this idea of being related to God, I think, is a really powerful concept, if that's taken in the way we think of family relations. You know, we're not just related in some abstract sense, that we're actually talking about our relations, you know, our family relations.
Mm-hmm.
There's a list here, is what I'm looking at. It's in paper 40, section 6, paragraph 3, where they're talking about why we are entitled to regard ourselves as being the sons of God. And then they have a list of five things.
Mm.
But the last one is number 5, says, there dwells within you a fragment of the universal Father, and you are thus directly related to the divine Father of all the sons of God. The Father of all the sons of God. So that idea, and then in number two, that comes up again, the related idea. They say a creator son of God became one of you. He is your elder brother, in fact. And if in spirit you become truly related brothers of Christ, the victorious Michael, then in spirit must you also be sons of that Father, which you have in common. Even the universal Father of all. So here they're talking about becoming related as brothers of Jesus, in a sense. And then they also talk about being related to the Father directly through the indwelling Spirit. So in both cases, I mean, if we lose that sense of being related to God, I mean, we're just like floating off into oblivion. I mean, there's nothing to tether us to anything, really, except our own immediate
desires. It's so fundamental.
And satisfactions, perhaps, but
of all the teachings of the Urantia book, to me, that idea that God lives in each one of us, that idea of the Father fragment, the divine indweller, the mystery monitor, the thought adjuster, whatever you want to call it, is so fundamental to our human health and happiness. It's so fundamental to our survival, to our understanding of all that is, and our ability to even have a relationship with God. And for me, you know, if we could give the world one thing, if the world could just accept that one reality, that God is in all of us, you know, and that we truly are related. We truly are.
Well, God is not just a father. He's a good father.
Oh, yeah. And he's
One of the...
we can count on it.
Yeah, it's given us a great gift.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, one of the books that Thomas Keating wrote, he wrote some 25 books. And, you know, he's the Franciscan monk that came up with centering prayer. Centering is a methodology of, actually, it's a worship methodology of joining with God. And one of his books, is the title always struck me. And the title of the book is Intimacy with God, which is really provocative. What he's saying is we can have an intimate relationship with God, not a faraway abstract relationship, but an intimate interior relationship with God. And I agree with you, Paul. I mean, I think that's central to what the world needs to hear, is that it's available to any one of us. And the additional idea, which is really pretty stunning theologically, is that not only is God's presence the deepest thing inside of us, the core of who we are, and we can have this intimate, nurturing parent-child relationship with God, but our destiny is to fuse with that parental presence and, in a sense, become a being where that parent-child relationship is playing out eternally and internally in us forever. That is such a powerful concept theologically. It's mind-boggling. And I don't see that anywhere in any of the other religious literatures, that there is an indwelling intimate presence of the actual God, and that our destiny is to fuse, to become one with that presence and be in a parent-child relationship interiorly forever. That's powerful. That's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. That is so powerful. I mean, we've already read this. We read it, you know, when we started our study on God. But this is from paper 2, section 5, paragraph 6. How unreasonable that you should not worship God, because the limitations of human nature and the handicaps of your material creation make it impossible for you to see him. Between you and God, there is a tremendous distance, physical space, to be traversed. There likewise exists a great gulf of spiritual differential, which must be bridged. But notwithstanding all that physically and spiritually separates you from the paradise personal presence of God, stop and ponder the solemn fact that God lives within you. He has in his own way already bridged the gulf. He has sent of himself his spirit to live in you and to toil with you as you pursue your eternal universe career. To me, that's priceless language.
Yeah. Where was that?
That's a bomb. That's from paper 2, section 5, paragraph 6. And actually those papers that we just read, are so amazingly beautiful. There's another place where it says, don't dream of him afar off in the skies, but I can't find that. I must have the wrong words.
Well, that's the one where they talk about prayer and the alter ego. It might be in there.
Not sure. Yeah, I was looking at afar off, and another one from 3 came up, paper 3, 1, 4. It says, the creature not only exists in God, but God also lives in the creature. We know we dwell in him because he lives in us. He has given us his spirit. This gift from the Paradise Father is man's inseparable companion. He is the ever-present and all-pervading God. The spirit of the everlasting Father is concealed in the mind of every mortal child. Man goes forth searching for a friend, while that very friend lives within his own heart. The true God is not afar off. He is a part of us. His spirit speaks from within us. The Father lives in the child. God is always with us. He is the guiding spirit of eternal destiny. And all of those, believe it or not, are quotes from other scripture. Almost every sentence in that paragraph is a quote, either from the Bible or somewhere. I mean, sometimes, I always assume that was biblical quotes, but they may not be. They may be from other spiritual writings too. So it'd be fun to kind of look those up sometime and just see where they're coming from. I bet Matthew Block has already done that, though. But, yeah. It's just such an amazing truth that, you know, we are the progeny of these great eternal transactions between the Trinity. Mm-hmm. And how far that extends and keeps extending, you know, how it's still even now growing. And
like this line from the ninth paragraph of section 4 of this same paper on the Eternal Son, where they say that in all of his merciful and affectionate personal contacts with the ascendant beings of the lower realms, the Eternal Son is just as kind and considerate, just as patient and long-suffering as are his paradise sons in the local universes. So we can think about Jesus, you know, we can see that in the character of Jesus. So they're just saying that, that's why he's like that, because the Eternal Son's like that. But I like how they put that. Just as kind and considerate, just as patient and long-suffering. You know, they know how it is. You know, because the Paradise Sons have incarnated, so they've had the human experience. So they know what we're dealing with, right?
Yeah.
So.
And is there any suffering more acute than that suffering that you feel as a parent when your child is suffering? I don't think so. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think that's the most acute suffering there is, actually. And I don't know a single parent that wouldn't say, oh, I'd rather suffer. I'd take it all away from you in a heartbeat if I could. I would take it on myself so that you don't ever have to feel it. That's really a parental thing, to suffer for your children. My friend says, I'm only as happy as my least happy child. I totally get that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
As they are afflicted,
very true.
We are
very
afflicted.
True.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and they promise to go through it all with us.
It's funny to hear, you know, with this conversation, it's funny to hear, you know, various Christians talk about, or people ask the question, does God suffer? It's like this
have
conversation.
Have you been a parent? That'd be the next question to ask.
Exactly. Is God a parent? Then yes, he does suffer.
Yes. I mean, it's at the heart of this entire conversation, yes.
Right. And the fact that the three members of the Trinity are all, you know, equal parts of this grand adventure that's going on.
Mm.
And that, you know, that comment also touched me, Chuck, about the Eternal Son, that he is just as loving. And I feel that, right? And it, we have something
kind
in common.
Kind and considerate.
Yeah.
Kind and considerate. I mean, those are really interesting descriptors.
Yeah.
You know, that
just as
kind
and considerate.
Yeah.
That's the God I know. He's kind.
Uh-huh.
You know, Gary said, I found that. Here's that quote, Polly, and it's from paper 5, 5, 2, 3. So we just read that paper. What a mistake to dream of God far off in the skies when the spirit of the universal Father lives within your own mind. Yeah. And Jesus said it in another way. He said, you know, men seek for God, you know, with weary hearts and aching feet, when all of that is within their own, you know, spiritual grasp within them. That one kind of choked me up.
Yeah. Well, we also have the personality circuit, which shouldn't be underestimated. But in a way, conceptually, it doesn't feel as intimate, even though it's just as real. You know, we can talk to God directly, and he'll hear us all the way on paradise through the personality circuit. There's no question about that. But to think of God as being so far away, that almost implies a sense of separateness, which really isn't there, even with personality circuit. But having spirit living within, that's very intimate. And that's very, you can kind of get that visceral sense of what that is about. And then especially when they talk about Cain with his adjuster looking out, you know, through his eyes or something like that, that's like, that gives me a sense, oh yeah, God is, my adjuster is experiencing everything that I'm experiencing. It has to, in order to create the offline transcripts, you know, of experiences and things of spiritual value. It has to be experiencing everything we're experiencing. So then you begin to get a sense, okay, I want to make this nice for my adjuster if I can, right? At least as much as possible. There's, in other words, there's a sense of, yeah, it's sort of like being invited in to your home, too. It's the same kind of thing.
Right.
I want to sort of clean up the place and make it nice if Jesus is coming over, you know. So we can have that same kind of feeling of our internal environment that our adjuster is sort of trapped in, incarcerated, they say, in one place, I think.
Incarcerated, yeah.
So we can sort of clean up our interior environment as well and make that nice for our adjuster, in a sense, you know, whatever that means, however you interpret that. But many, many domestic.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that's, you know, in a word, that's God's will. That's what God most wants for us. You know, doing the will of God is nothing more or less an exhibition of our willingness to share our inner lives with God.
Right.
Yeah. He just wants our companionship, you know. And that's the irony of it, is where, you know, all these people are dying on the vine out of loneliness and isolation.
Uh-huh.
When that, the intimacy of that nurturing relationship is available to them at any moment that they would choose to enter it in faith. But I think our job is to help educate people to the possibility and even how to enter that inner space and sense that presence and begin a life of shared companionship. And that's what people are dying of spiritual hunger for.
Yeah.
That's what they're famishing for.
They resist that out of fear. You know, maybe they've been mistaught about the nature and character of God. So I don't want anything to do with
Here's,
them.
Here's one of the biggest fears of all, the fear of being made a fool of, right? The fear of being a fool.
This goes back to families of origin, right? This goes back to families of origin. So what happened when children grow up and they're rejected and they're neglected and they're basically taught that they're worthless and they're not of value, then when as adults they think about approaching God, their fundamental assumption is a projection of that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, God doesn't want anything to do with me. You know, I'm
going
to get rejected again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not even going to try.
Mm-hmm.
My safety lies in just hunkering down and surviving, you know. And it's a basic child, you know, dysfunctional family of origin dilemma. And so what you have to do is you have to say to folks, you know, there's a real possibility here, but you have to take the first step in trust and muster the courage to try in faith to approach God and ask for that love. And then it's forthcoming.
Mm.
But you're right. It's a big step for many people because they've been so hurt. You know, trauma.
Yeah, and there's teaching involved. Like that God will never abandon you. You know,
mm-hmm.
He taught that. You know, such a big deal.
Well,
yeah,
we can
you know?
Relate to God in this way, and that is that we have a great gift to give. We've been given a great gift, and we have it to give. And it is, as Pam said early on, it is hard when they don't want it, and it breaks your heart. On some level, when they don't want it. You know, when you know it would make such a difference for them. But,
maybe get ripened up a little bit. That's all.
Yeah, I think it's
Well, I like this little saying.
I like this
little saying where it says, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. But you sure can make him thirsty. You sure can make him thirsty.
Well, that's our job.
that's our job, and, I think, is to really
and that's our
make,
show
make
for
people
today.
Yeah.
You got the last word, Marvin. We're down to the last few seconds anyway. Thanks for listening, you guys. Thanks, Chuck, Marvin, Bam. Wonderful discussion.
Yes.
And to everyone on the board, we ran out right out of time. But what a great discussion. Thank you so much.
Yeah, good stuff.
I always
good
feel
stuff.
So good after we're done.
Yeah.
All right. Well, have a great week, everyone.
Yeah,
yeah.
Love you guys.
Love
you,
guys.
Love you, too.
Bye-bye.
God bless.